The man, Doc, gets up off me and takes Teddy in his arms. "Kid," Tolliver says, shaking me by the shoulders. "There's no Teddy here. My boy is sick. Can't you see that? You better get out of here." "Your boy," I keep on yelling. "He's my brother. You kidnapped him."
"Simon?"
Doc calls from the bathroom. I try to find the wrench then, on the ground, but somehow it's not there anymore. Tolliver goes off to the bathroom and I race to follow him. The noise of the water is very loud. "Kid," he says, "I don't know what you're talking about. My boy, my son, is sick." Teddy is stripped and lying in the bathtub as the water fills around him. His eyes are nearly shut, and his face red and sweaty, though at the same time he is shivering from the cold.
"That's my brother. That's Teddy. What did you do to him? Teddy!"
Tolliver gets my wrists and shoves me into a sitting position on the tile, and Doc comes over and points his finger right in my face.
"Who are you?" he demands. "What are you doing here? Listen to me. There is no Teddy here."
Tolliver then grabs me by the wrists again and yanks me to my feet.
"See? This is my son, Colin. He's real sick."
I stare at Tolliver, and I see a genuine kindness in his dark eyes. He has a big, broad face, and is just big and broad in general. His skin is a reddish brown, and he has large hands with long fingers. He places one of those hands gently on my shoulder.
"Kid, you are obviously confused. Why don't you start at the beginning and tell us who you are?"
I stammer, so goddamn frustrated now I can't fight the tears back.
"My brother, he was kidnapped 2 years ago from Ocean Beach, and now he's here. You have him."
Tolliver shakes his head, but his eyes soften and I see something like pity there.
"Kid," he starts. "Kid, come on, take a look at my son. Take a good look. Slow down, breathe, and look. This is Colin, my son."
My shoulders drop and I do what he says. I look at Teddy through the blur. I rub my eyes and look again. The boy has turned pale and his lips are bluish purple and he's shivering terribly. His hair is matted down and greasy. His dark brown hair, his large forehead, his thin trembling lips. Dark brown hair. It is not Teddy. He doesn't even resemble Teddy. Not really. Teddy is a redhead with freckles. Teddy's nose was broken when he was 6, and it's been crooked ever since. Teddy has a wide mouth and big green eyes. I put my hands on the edge of the bathtub and try to steady myself. The tears come so I can hardly breathe.
"It's not him," I cry. "It's not Teddy."
Simon Tolliver puts his arm around me.
"Hey, it's okay," he says. "I remember now. That case. The kid who was kidnapped at Ocean Beach 2 years ago. Teddy, Bryant? Was that it?"
"Uh-huh," I say. "Teddy Bryant Cole."
"But what made you think he was here?"
the doctor asks, working at the boy's, not Teddy's, forehead with a cloth.
The police report," I whimper. "You were the last chance I had."
I feel Tolliver's hand rubbing my back, and I want to go home suddenly, so goddamn badly.
"It's okay," he says,
and then he turns to the doctor.
"Doc, you don't know this about me, but I had a real troubled past. I was in prison, and I did some bad things, but I've changed. I went to counseling, I met Cheryl, I turned my life around. It's been years now."
And then to me,
"But I promise you, kid, I had nothing to do with that boy's disappearance. The police questioned me. I didn't do anything."
The doctor clears his throat.
"We don't have time for this. You go get those clothes in a bag together, and get a blanket to wrap Colin in. He's ready. We need to leave immediately. None of that matters now."
He leans over and pulls the drain from the tub.
"Yeah, okay. Thanks, Leo," Tolliver tells him. "We'll get you taken care of too, kid. Don't you worry," he says to me.
He leaves then, and the doctor grabs a few white towels off the rack. Rubbing the boy's body roughly with the towel, he continues talking, murmuring through gritted teeth.
"Don't know what you were thinking, bursting in like that. It's a good way to get yourself killed. You're damn lucky you came in here when Colin was so sick. Simon most likely has shot you as an intruder. You go sneaking up on him.
I'm sorry, I whisper. He calls out to Tolliver then, pressing the back of his hand against the boy's forehead.
Simon, buddy, we gotta go.
The doctor picks the boy up and Tolliver comes over, wrapping him in a military-looking surplus blanket.
All right, let's get a move on, the doctor says. Kid, we'll drop you off at the police station on the way.
No, I plead. No, please, I just want to go home.
He nods. Okay, well then hurry, come on.
We all walk out together, Tolliver carrying his son. The doctor fires up the engine. Tolliver holds his boy in his arms. We drive fast to the hospital. And I think about Teddy. The fog closes in around us. And we drive. 35. The bus up the 101 from Mercy Hospital lumbers through the night. Up here, closer to the city, the fog has been blown clear, and there is only the starless black above reflecting the toxic glow of the lights downtown. There's only one other person on the bus, a young guy, probably just a little older than me, wearing big studio headphones and bobbing his head to whatever music he's listening to. I sit at the very back of the bus with my body folded up, hugging my knees tightly and rocking slightly. Simon Tolliver and the doctor were both super nice to me. They made me promise several times to go straight home. Tolliver even gave me a little money. They put me on the bus and made sure I had everything I might need. Really, they were so sweet to me. I'm grateful. And so goddamn sad. Because it really, truly is over now. Teddy is gone. And I feel that in me, just like I felt he was alive before. It's like somehow inside of me, there's this knowledge that is real and deep and penetrating. Teddy is dead. The voice whispers, that cool breeze again blowing through my mind, calming. It tells me that God's plan was not for me to save Teddy, but to accept his death and save myself. There was no way I could move on before. Now I can. I can move on and finally be fully and completely with Eliza. That is God's will for me. It whispers in my ear and cools my brain even as I mourn Teddy and feel the tears burning my eyes. I lay my head against the plastic of the bus window. My hands shake, and I cry and remember Teddy and remember how he used to be. I see him running on the beach that day. He's wading through the water, and it's blue and calm and perfect. I don't know how the hell that ocean could have swallowed him up. But it did. It swallowed him.
Eliza, the voice whispers.
Yes, Eliza. She is the missing piece. I need to get back to her. I need to be with her, and I need to be with her now. I will tell her everything. I will make her understand. Because it is over. And if I am going to survive this, I need to be with her. I am ready. And nothing is going to stop me. The heat courses through my body, and there's sweat all down my neck and back. I get off the bus and transfer up Fulton to Divisadero in Hayes Street. It's a short walk up around the park to Eliza's. I climb the stairs. The crows begin to gather. Just on the edge of my vision, they swoop into position on the wires surrounding the house. They peck at their own dark feathers with their sharp, pointed beaks, preening, rolling their heads, staring with their shiny black shark eyes. I try the door and it swings open. The crows caw at me, spreading their wings wide. They press in now, flying down onto the railing, settling on the concrete near my feet. Dozens more take their places on the wires, the lawn, the trees. A number of them settle on a car parked in the driveway. The car. Not Eliza's. Not her mother's. A feeling like dread forms in my stomach and shoots up along my spine. Eliza? I call. There is no answer. I push inside, scan the living room. The crows, they are here too, scattered across the carpet, perched on the walls of bookshelves. There are more and more of them screeching into the room, swooping in from outside and upstairs. I hear a shout. It is Eliza. I hear the voice again whispering, "The crows. They have her." I run, sprinting up to her bedroom. The birds cry, seemingly all at once. I throw her door open. Eliza is on her bed, and she's covered in them. She cries out, screams as they devour her. "Stop!" I yell. "Stop! Get off of her!" I grab their oily bodies, throwing them off her, pulling them apart, hitting them, strangling them, repeating all the while, "I'm here, Eliza. I'm here. I'm here." I swing my fists and pound and tear and pull until I feel my hands slick with blood. I will tear them apart for touching her. I will destroy them. "Miles! Jesus, what are you doing?" Eliza screams. "Get off! Get off!" I yell at the crows, punching and grabbing at them. "Miles, stop!" The crows swarm on me and I'm thrown back. I fall onto the hardwood floor and hit my head hard. Eliza kneels in front of me. "Miles!" My eyes blur and water, and I blink and blink again. Eliza has a blanket wrapped around her body to cover herself. I turn to face the birds, to defend against another attack. But the crows are gone. Vanished. On the floor beside me, I see that kid. What's his name? From Preston's party. He's holding his bleeding mouth and nose. And he's naked. "What is this?" I shake my head, trying to understand. "Dude, Miles, this isn't what you think," the guy says, standing. I remember now. Kevin. "Wait, what?" I turn toward Eliza, and I get it. "Fuck," I say. Then I drop to my knees and vomit. The hot liquid bursts out of my nose and throat. "Miles!" Eliza screams. "Miles! Jesus!" The guy walks back over to the bed and starts putting his clothes on. He laughs then, telling us, "You're both fucking crazy." He gathers his shoes and socks in his arms and storms out the door. I vomit again as he walks past. "Fuck," I say. Eliza comes over to try to help me, but I yell at her to leave me alone. I get up off the floor, shaky, breathing heavily. "I'm sorry," Eliza pleads with me, sitting back on the bed. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No," I scream at the top of my lungs. "Fuck you. Fuck you." I trip over myself and fall, and then I get up again and go running down the stairs. I want to scream and fight and tear myself apart. Outside, the air is cold and still. The crows are gone. And so is everything else in my whole fucking world. 36. It is dark, and everyone is asleep by the time I get home. I walk silently to my dad's office and then to the bathroom. The knife I'm using was a wedding present given to my parents that has never actually been used, as far as I know. It's Japanese. Large, almost like a butcher's knife. I had to take it from a fancy wooden box in the top drawer of the roll-top desk in my father's office. I'm using the expensive knife because I know it will be sharp. Much sharper than that dull-as-shit IKEA knife set we have in the kitchen. I take the blade into the tub, wearing my sweatpants, because I totally don't want to be stark naked when they find me. I sit cross-legged with my back pressed up against the mildewed tile. The drops of water left over from whoever took a shower last are soaking into my pants, and the smell of soap and shampoo and whatever else is overpowering. I breathe out long and slow. The bathroom is small and cramped and bright, and I would have preferred to light some candles or something, but I guess I have to make do with what I've got. There aren't any pictures in here at all, only the mirror over the sink, and a lot of toiletries and dried flowers and bath salts, and my mother's pretty perfume bottles she never uses. I decide to cut my right wrist first, holding the knife in my left, 'cause my right hand is much stronger. That way, once my right wrist is done, I'll still be able to use the hand to finish the job. The voice is whispering softly, telling me that this is what I deserve. I have destroyed everything. This is all that is left. "You are a parasite," it tells me. "You aren't fit for survival. You are a burden on your family. You are a burden on humanity. You are sick, diseased. The world will be better off without you."
it tells me what to do.
Cut with a knife, it says. Start with the right one.
And so I do as it says. I take the knife in my left hand and cut it into my right wrist. I try to do it fast, without even thinking about it. I draw the knife quickly and deeply, straight across the veins. It stings like a motherfucker. That's what I can say. It stings and burns, and it fucking hurts. It hurts so much that I drop the knife. I'm struggling for breath like I've just jumped into the freezing cold ocean. 1,000 needles cover me and the blood comes. Deep purplish, crimson, black. Somehow I do manage to grab the knife with my right hand, though, just like I planned. Gritting my teeth, I draw it quickly, albeit less deeply, across the other wrist. This time I vomit. I flop onto my side and throw up into the shower drain. I choke and cough and retch as the vomit forces itself up and out of my throat. I'm covered in blood and puke, and I feel myself quickly passing out. The only thing left to do now is call 911 to make sure the EMTs find me before my parents do. Or, God forbid, Jane. To scar her like that would be worse than anything. I can't let that happen. No matter what. So I swing my body back around to where I put my phone. Luckily, 911 is pretty easy to dial, even with both wrists sliced open. But I guess that's probably the point. My twitching fingers find the numbers and I wait, fighting to stay conscious. Click. 911 emergency. How can I help you? My breathing comes fast and shallow, so I can barely get the words to come out of me. There's been a... No, I killed myself. Pause. What? I'm sorry, sir, what? Can you repeat that? More breathing. I said I killed myself. 1717 Clement Street. You killed yourself? I close my eyes. The back bathroom. What? Hello, sir, are you there? Please stay on the line with me, sir. I feel tired suddenly. So deeply fucking tired. The curtain falls. There is only darkness. Part 3. 37. It takes me a few moments to realize what's happened and where I am. The room is bright and blinding. I'm being choked by something so I can't talk, but I need to. I need help right away. There is this giant plastic tube down my throat, and my eyes are watering, and I keep on gagging as I call out, "Ah! Ah!" And then a nurse is there standing in front of me, cocking her head to one side as my eyes go wide, and I jerk my body back and forth, still gagging, and begging her to get this thing out of my throat. She leaves then, if you can believe that. She leaves, and so I start flailing and making as much noise as I can to get them to pay attention to me and get this thing out of me. I'm not sure how long that lasts, but finally two nurses come in, and one, this large drag queen-looking guy, says to me, "Just hold on, sugar." And he holds on to me while the other nurse pulls the tube out of my stomach and out of my throat. And I gag and breathe and gasp for more and more breath. "Well, you awake now, honey? Good. The doctor will be here shortly." And then the other nurse starts messing around with one of the IV drips I have going, and shoots in what I imagine must be a bunch of morphine, because I start to fade out again pretty quick after that. "You sleep," the nice drag queeny one says. "The doctor will come." I nod my head, trying to say thank you, but my throat's burning too bad. "Shh, shh, don't talk." My eyes close again. And that's when, suddenly, I remember. I failed. Again. 38. Waking a second time, I sit up all at once out of the deepest blackness. There is someone there, next to me, whispering in my ear, "Get out. Get out of here." The brightness floods in, and I blink my eyes and call out, "Who's there?"
The voice speaks from some hidden place inside me. Get out of here. Get the fuck out of here. My breath comes in gasps. My throat is dry and pained and raspy. I grab at the needles all stuck in my arms and pull them free, along with the tape that held them fastened. Get out. Get out. There is a plastic curtain around my bed that I take hold of to try to hoist myself up, but it tears away from the metal frame, and I find myself sprawled out on the cold, chemical-smelling linoleum, the curtain all tangled around me. Get out. Get out. I start to crawl, but something is stopping me, something at my waist. I reach down and feel what is there, burning and tugging at the place between my legs. Get out. I will get out, I say aloud. I will get out. There is a piercing noise, like an alarm going off loud in my ears. Help me, I yell. Help me, get this out of me. But the voice has abandoned me suddenly. Hello? Hello? Help me. Hello? There is nothing but the alarm screaming. It screams like a siren. I hold my palms up against my ears. And then someone else is there, holding me under my arms. Jesus Cristo, kid. My head thrashes wildly. I feel myself being lifted up. Hold him! Hold him! The burning between my legs intensifies. Get off of me! I yell. What the fuck? There is a great pressure on my chest, and then something sharp cutting into my side. Get him down! Hold him! The alarm stops screaming at me then, but the pain in my side just keeps getting worse and fucking worse. I'm having trouble breathing. Your ribs are broken, says a voice, from the CPR. Lie still. I do as I'm told. I lie, blinking my eyes and trying to see. I'm sorry, I say. Someone was here. Someone was making me leave. And then there is a loud sobbing noise next to me. And I turn and finally recognize something. My mother. She is hunched over, crying, her shoulders heaving, and at the same time shouting, He needs his medication. Please, I told you, he needs his medication. She is very pale looking, and her gray hair is knotted on top of her head. God damn it, I say hoarsely. This is exactly what I didn't want. I feel the almost weightlessness of my mom's frail hand on my shoulder. Hush, Nomai. Hush, baby. And then louder to the nurses, or whoever else is there. He needs his medication. Please, I whisper. There is the prick of a needle in the crook of my arm, and then a warmth flooding me. Am I peeing? I ask. And then it's all black again. 39. My mother is there, and my father too, both staring at me intently as my eyes try to focus. That's better now, isn't it? My mom asks me. And I have to admit that it is. I feel calm and clear for the first time. I know fully where I am. I mean, I'm in the hospital. There are needles stuck in me, connected to fluid drips, and a catheter up in between my legs, which must have been what remained attached to me when I tried to run away. There are machines monitoring my heart rate and my blood pressure. There are thick bandages wrapped around both arms. Fuck, man. They've stitched me up and put me back together again. And they must have gotten me on the right meds now, too, because I'm not acting all psycho. Mom? She smiles. Yes, yes, I'm here. I smile back, suddenly aware of how parched I am. My tongue is thick and swollen. Water? Is there water? My mom turns, and I can see that my dad is standing there behind her. My request triggers a chain reaction of people looking over their shoulders. My mom, my dad, the doctor, a male nurse. Actually, it stops at him. He goes off, returning a second later with a plastic cup in his hand. Here you go, he says, his voice deep and startling. He helps me to sit up and take the cup with my right hand. The wrists on both sides are still sore as fucking hell. I gulp down the water. Thank you, I manage to say. He bows his head, and then the doctor comes over and puts a calloused hand on my forehead. He speaks very gently. You are still running a slight fever,
but the worst of it should be over now.
Thank you, I say again.
He nods, adjusting the stethoscope hanging around his neck.
My name is Dr. Fleeterer, Miles. I was the doctor on call the night you...
He pauses.
Came in here.
His eyes are so transparent and blue and kind. I can't help but look away.
Oh, I say dumbly.
And now, he continues, audibly tapping his foot on the linoleum. Well, I've been working with your parents on your continuing care plan. My dad steps forward at that moment. His skin is gray and ashen looking.
Hey, buddy, he says, putting his hand up.
I smile.
Hey, Dad.
My voice cracks. I can see his eyes are red and swollen from crying, and I think maybe I might cry then, too. I mean, he looks so helpless standing there, so awkward and unsure.
We just want to do what's best for you, he says, shifting his weight from one foot to the other.
That's right, my mom says, walking up between my dad and the doctor, moving some hair back from my eyes. She leans forward and kisses my cheek. I try to smell the smell of her, but hospital disinfectant and plastic obscures everything else.
We just want what's best for you, she repeats.
It's fucking cold in here, so I'm shivering. The shivering runs all the way through me. I don't know. Maybe it's the fever. All I know is that I want to sleep again so badly it hurts. My joints crack and I go on shivering. I start.
I mean, it's so cold. Could we... Is there a heater?
My parents both look at the doctor, who again looks at the nurse.
Could you bring Miles another couple blankets?
He asks him, and then to me.
I'm sorry, Miles. It's a hospital.
I shiver.
Oh.
Okay.
What you need is some more rest, he says.
I nod.
Yes, good, he continues on.
That's good.
We just wanted to talk to you, very briefly, your mother and father and I, about your aftercare plan. And I believe we've found the best possible solution for your situation.
I manage to laugh a little.
A brain transplant?
The doctor smiles, still looking very kind.
No, I'm afraid not. But we have gotten you on a new medication. It's called Clozaril, and it's proven to be somewhat of a miracle drug with severe schizophrenic patients. So that's something to be hopeful about. And we are going to transfer you to our psych ward here at the hospital and keep you on a 72-hour hold where you'll be seen by our specialist, Dr. Dubonis. Do you understand all that?
My attention shifts over to my mom then, who has started crying, however silently. She holds my stare and smiles through her tears.
A psych ward?
I ask, my teeth starting to chatter.
My mom's eyes remain fixed on mine.
She nods slowly.
It's just for a few days.
Christ, fuck, I say, the tears coming now.
I'm sorry. Please, can I just come home?
The doctor clears his throat again.
No, Miles. You need to get well. I'm afraid there's no choice.
My mom puts a hand on my forehead as I start to cry.
Hush now, hush.
She has just the saddest, sweetest smile. My dad too, really. I lie back down on the bed and let my eyes start to close.
Eliza?
I say, half sleeping already.
Does Eliza know?
The sound of the overhead fluorescent lighting is loud, crackling through the silence.
Don't worry, my dad finally whispers. That's all behind you now.
He puts a hand gently on my forehead and tells me again not to worry. I turn shivering onto my side. I pull the blanket up over my head. I sleep, but do not dream. I know now I will never dream again. Because in my life, there are no dreams left.
Part 4. 40.
The group room is pretty much the same as my room in the ward, but with a couple motivational posters on the wall, and instead of beds, a circle of plastic orange chairs. Dr. Dubonis, the primary care physician on the unit, sits with his back facing the two caged windows.
He is very thin and sickly looking, with pale yellow pockmarked skin and a scruffy, graying beard. His hands are large and appear to be covered in some kind of sores or blisters that he keeps picking at with his long thumbnail. He is fidgety and jerks around a lot, and seems like he should be a patient here, not the doctor in charge of us all. But the little pin on his uniform does read Henry Dubonis, M.D., so I guess he must be legit. Plus everyone else seems to be looking at him like he's in charge. There is a whiteboard on wheels behind him, with the acronym HALT written across it with a nearly dried-up red marker. It's an acronym I'm familiar with. HALT. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Meaning, in order not to go crazy, you're never supposed to let yourself get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. It's actually pretty good advice, I'd say, even if it does happen to be in the lexicon of pretty much every goddamn therapist ever. At least, that's been my experience. But anyway, HALT. Sure, it makes sense. Dr. Dubonis explains the whole thing a couple times while everyone takes their seats, and then he goes on and turns his attention to me, which makes me cross my arms and legs and try to make myself just as small as I can. Well now, as I'm sure you've all noticed, we have a new patient today. And I thought, before we get started... A girl just to the left of me stamps her foot and leans forward, putting her elbows on her knees, shouting, "Nah, fuck, man, let's start! Let's get this fucking over with!" She's Japanese, I think, with an accent and everything. Punk-looking, with short-cut hair dyed different shades of red, and all these tattoos and white scars up and down her arms. She wears a ripped-up tank top and loose-fitting pajama bottoms. Actually, pretty much everyone is wearing pajamas. Even the tranny with his-her makeup done and a long black wig and press-on nails is wearing pajamas and fuzzy little slippers. Well, not that little. His-her feet are at least a size 12 or 13. "Huh, where you gotta go, Yuka?" he-she calls out. "You ain't going nowhere. Shit." A couple of the other patients laugh, but the Japanese girl, Yuka, just kind of scrunches her face all up and then kicks the ground again. "Fuck you, sweet pea," she yells. "I got places, man, fuck you." There's some more laughter, and then Dr. Dubonis clears his throat a couple times. "Sweet pea, Yuka, please," he says, but not angrily. "We have a new patient, and..." This real weird-looking psycho kid cuts in.
"You said that already."
His head is shaved, with cuts all over it.
"Yes, well..." Dr. Dubonis continues, picking more at his scabby hands. "Nonetheless, this is Miles Cole. He's going to be with us for a while."
I shift around in the hard plastic seat, feeling all the eyes turned on me. Eyes like the crow's eyes, black and vacant and darting. Dr. Dubonis leans forward, talking to me gently.
"Would you like to tell us about yourself, Miles? Can you tell the group why you're here?"
Yeah, I'm Miles. That's my brilliant introduction.
"Fucking said that already,"
the psycho kid with all the cuts says, rolling his eyes. A shy, sweet-looking kid chews on his dirty fingernails and stutters.
Let him talk.
Dr. Dubonis smiles, encouraging.
"Yes, thank you, Max."
And then to me.
"Go ahead, Miles."
I nod.
Well, I tried to kill myself, I say. "But I didn't."
There's some laughter. One girl, small, with mousy brown hair, tells me,
"Congratulations,"
all sarcastic-like.
"Well, would you like to share your diagnosis with us?"
the doctor asks me, not letting up. I shrink back into my chair a little more.
Schizophrenia.
A few of the patients clap. Dr. Dubonis smiles.
"Good. Very good. Should we go around then and introduce ourselves and tell Miles why we're here?"
Yuka stands up suddenly, knocking her chair over and then kicking it when it's down.
"Fuck this!" she shouts.
Dr. Dubonis is up then too, but like he's aware of keeping his distance from her.
"Do you not feel like joining us today, Yuka?"
She flips him off and yells at all of us,
"Fuck you, fucking assholes!"
She stomps toward the door, but then almost instantly there are two men in white uniforms grabbing hold of her as she screams and kicks and flails her arms.
Get off me! Get the fuck off of me!
You'll come back to group when you've calmed down a little bit, okay? The doctor says. And then the two men carry her off, screaming all the way down the hall about how we could all go fuck ourselves. Dr. Dubonis goes and sits back down and smiles, and no one else seems to care that someone was dragged from the room against her will. Though I figure, maybe they're just used to it. Okay, sorry all, the doctor says cheerfully. Where were we? As if in response, this one boy, who'd been sitting very quietly, suddenly jerks up and makes this terrible screaming noise super loud that startles the shit out of me. Well, actually, no, it's not a scream exactly. It's like the sound is forcing itself out of his body. He trembles and shakes, and then the vocalizations come pouring out of his mouth like,
"Ah! Ah!"
It happens two or three times in a row. Jesus Christ, this super overweight goth-looking girl says, rolling her eyes. This is such a waste of time. The boy does his weird vocalization thing again.
Ah! Huck!
The tranny, Sweet Pea, crosses and uncrosses his/her legs. Ain't that the truth? The boy screams out. He keeps on screaming. He screams for all of us. 41. Looking out the small, caged window above my bed, I can see crows gathering in the treetops, silhouetted by the perpetually gray sky. The sun is obscured by the heavy mist coming in from the ocean. There is only the gray in the tops of the trees, and the crows circling there, and the cage around my window. My window in my room. My room in the goddamn psych ward. I stand on the frame of my bed, watching as the crows dive in circle. I think about Eliza. I try not to think about Eliza. I feel sick in my stomach. I feel like I could cry, maybe. The door opens behind me. I turn around. It's that kid Max from the group earlier. He must be my roommate. He's real thin and hollowed out looking. His hair all choppy, like he cut it himself. He keeps his eyes on the ground when he talks and has a super bad stutter. I figure he must be maybe a year or two older than I am, but definitely not more.
Oh, you're in here then?
Yeah, is that okay? He walks over to the closet where he takes a wool cardigan off one of the wooden hangers.
Of course.
He sits down on his bed, clearing away some of the magazines.
Have you been shown where everything is yet?
Really, he seems nice enough, so I smile and sit down on my own bed. Yeah, thanks. I think so. We sit quietly for a few moments. He crosses his legs, and so I cross mine too. I say, what are you doing here? You don't seem crazy like the rest of them. He smiles shyly.
I can't function in the real world.
Yeah, me neither. 42. The staff room is tiny and cramped, then overcrowded with filing cabinets and stacks of patients' charts and VHS tapes. The door is half open, and I stand there for a few seconds waiting to be noticed by the giant woman looking at a People magazine or the paunchy white guy with greasy hair thinning on his head. The name tag pinned to his chest reads Carl. The one pinned to the woman's chest reads Edna. Edna and Carl. I knock gently on the door. Edna looks up and squints at me through her thick horn-rimmed glasses. She doesn't appear to be too thrilled about me having interrupted her.
Yes, she asks. Can we help you with something?
Her skin is creased and leathery like an old worn-out suitcase. Her eyes are black, fading to gray around the edges. She's wearing a lot of lipstick and has painted-on eyebrows. She taps her white orthopedic hospital shoes like she wants me to get to the point.
Sorry, I say, my voice faltering. I just... someone paged me?
She takes off her glasses, cleaning them on the white thermal undershirt she's wearing beneath her blue scrubs. She turns to look over behind her at this big whiteboard hanging on the wall.
There's a list written on it of a bunch of patients' names cross-referenced with time slots where different appointments have been filled in. I see my own name, since it's at the top of the list, and then next to it in red marker. Dr. S. Frankel. You see that? Edna asked me. Yeah. So you're gonna have to hurry, okay? You've got your meeting with your doctor.
Dr. Frankel?
Yes, he's your private psychiatrist, isn't he?
Yeah, but what's he doing here?
She lets her shoulders rise and fall.
Guess your parents must have set it up.
I nod.
So you better get down there, huh?
She continues, kind of sarcastic sounding.
You know the way?
I tell her I don't. And so begrudgingly, she pushes up from her chair with considerable effort and tells me to follow her. She walks out the door. And so I do, too. 43. Dr. Frankel is sitting in a hard plastic chair in one of the visiting rooms. He looks the same as ever, wearing that stupid tracksuit, with his short, stubby legs dangling inches off the ground. Still, I have to admit, there's something kind of comforting about seeing him again.
Miles, my boy, he says. I'm so sorry about all this.
He gestures to the seat across from him, and so I sit down, crossing my legs and arms.
It was my fault, I tell him.
I stopped taking my medication. I flushed it. All of it. He reaches out his hand as though to comfort me, but then stops himself. I guess remembering some doctor-patient bullshit or whatever.
It wasn't your fault, my boy. It was nobody's fault.
Can you tell me what happened?
I nod. Yeah, I guess so. Just take your time. It's all going to be all right.
I nod some more, staring down at my shoes, chewing at the inside of my cheek. But as soon as I start talking, it all comes pouring out of me, everything. About the crows, the voice, Eliza, Teddy being dead.
Teddy.
Dr. Frankel stops me, holding his hand up.
You've talked about him before, haven't you?
Yeah, of course. He clears his throat.
Yes, but who is this Teddy?
What do you mean?
Teddy, my brother,
the one I thought was kidnapped.
He squints at me. I didn't realize you thought he was your brother.
It's my turn to ask him now.
What do you mean, thought he was my brother?
He is my brother. He's dead, though. I've come to accept that. Dr. Frankel stares at me for a moment, as though turning something around in his brain.
Miles, you don't have a brother. You have a sister.
I clench my fist tightly.
Of course I do. Or did. Teddy Bryant Cole. He went missing the same day I had my first episode at Ocean Beach. I thought he'd been kidnapped. I've been trying to track him down. But now I know he must have drowned. Everyone tried to tell me. I wouldn't listen.
Teddy Bryant?
Teddy Bryant Cole, yeah. My brother.
He breathes in through his nose.
Miles, I'm sorry, but you have no brother. I don't know how to make you understand. But you have no brother. It must be a delusion brought on by your illness.
I jump to my feet then, knocking over the chair behind me in the process. There's this heat burning through me, and I feel my heart pounding in my head, and I can't even hear as I yell,
You don't know what you're talking about! What the hell are you talking about? Jesus Christ, you're all fucking crazy! You're fucking crazy!
He says something to me I can't hear, but I don't fucking care. I scream,
Fuck you! Just leave me alone!
And I storm out. There is a sickness in my stomach, and I feel my head spin and a sweat breaks out all over my body. This is crazy. This whole thing. The world spins around and around. And then my eyes roll back. And it all goes black. 44. Through the blur of too bright light, I see Dr. Dubonis looking down at me. He smiles then and helps me sit up. And I see that I'm lying on the couch in his office. Dr. Frankel is there looking through a stack of papers behind Dr. Dubonis's roll-top desk in the corner.
Here, Miles, drink this, Dr. Dubonis tells me, handing over a paper cup filled with water
and what I think is some emergency, electrolyte, whatever. I do as I'm told, and then I try to stand up, but it's like my legs don't work.
Just hold on, Dr. Dubonis says, putting a hand on my shoulder. Dr. Frankel and I, we want to talk to you about something.
My jaw clicks back and forth.
About my brother?
Miles, Dr. Frankel says. I know this is hard for you, but listen. That name, Teddy Bryant, I knew it sounded familiar.
Yeah, duh, my brother.
Miles, please, just listen, Dr. Dubonis tells me. Dr. Frankel leans forward, handing me the stack of papers.
Teddy Bryant, Dr. Frankel says, is the name of a child who did disappear. You're not wrong about that. But he's not your brother.
I look down at the papers in my hands, but the words are all blurred out. There is a picture of Teddy, though. That's certain.
This is him, I say. This is Teddy.
Yes, Miles, yes, it is Teddy. But look, Dr. Dubonis printed these just now. They're from the Chronicle website. Can you see what it says there?
I squint and try to make out the words. It's an article about Teddy, from when he disappeared.
Yes, but look, Miles. It's Teddy Bryant, of the Bryant family. Teddy Bryant, he continues, is the son of Bruce and Lorraine Bryant. He has a sister, Sophie Bryant. He was 7 years old when, 2 years ago, he disappeared from Ocean Beach. According to your file, it was exactly 1 week after you had your first psychotic episode at that same beach. You were probably still in the hospital and still recuperating from your attack when the story of the Bryant boys' disappearance was all over the news. After your episode, you were experiencing intense guilt and feelings of shame. You blamed yourself, and you thought your family blamed you. Somehow the news of Teddy Bryant's disappearance got all mixed together with your guilt for what you believed you were doing to your parents. The Bryant boy became the physical manifestation of your guilt. Your subconscious needed to assign your guilt to something solid and concrete, like a missing brother.
Now listen, flipping through the article in front of me, I read the names Bruce and Lorraine Bryant. I read the date. I read the description of the incident.
Dr. Frankel leans forward and smiles at me, his eyes flashing kindness and warmth. My hands begin to shake as I turn the pages over and over.
You mean, I start, my voice shaking just as badly as my hands.
You mean all this time? For 2 years I've been blaming myself? I've been trying to,
you mean, it was all a...
Could this possibly be true? Tears burn in my eyes.
Part of your disease, he says gently.
My mind flashes back to the police department. Teddy Bryant, the lady at the front desk said. But I added the Cole. Teddy Bryant Cole, I'd said. But she was already on the phone, trying to get that detective for me. The file I stole. The date that was wrong. Except it wasn't wrong. I was wrong. Or just fucking crazy. Jane and my mom and dad. I kept apologizing to them for what happened. I thought they knew I was talking about Teddy, but they must have thought I was talking about my sickness. My mom's office, the house, no pictures anywhere. No pictures, because there never was a Teddy Bryant Cole. There was only me. I nod and shiver.
Jesus, fuck. I'm crazy. I'm fucking crazy.
Dr. Frankel leans forward, and this time puts a hand gently on my back.
You're not crazy. You're sick.
Sick and fucking crazy.
But this means you're free now. Can't you see that? You never hurt anyone. You're not responsible. You can stop punishing yourself. You can let yourself live again.
I feel the barely there pressure of his hand on my back, and I breathe and I close my eyes. The son of a bitch is right. If there's no Teddy Cole, then I can't very well go on blaming myself for his disappearance. If there's no Teddy Cole, then I did nothing wrong. If there's no Teddy Cole, there is no Teddy Cole. For 2 years, he was all I could think about, all I would let myself think about. Without that, what do I have? Without that, who am I?
45.
Closer, oh man. I hate sounding like a goddamn advertisement, but it does seem to be working. The crows are gone, Teddy is gone, the voice of God or the universe or whatever is gone. Even my obsession with Eliza seems pretty well gone. From what both doctors say, I'd come to hate myself because of my disease, and so I was always, like, desperately trying as hard as I could to run away from the fact that I was mentally ill. But in here, they're trying to teach me how to accept my illness and learn how to love myself, as fucking lame as that sounds, in spite of it. They keep telling me it's not my fault. And I know it's not my fault, but I guess I don't always feel that way. So they're trying to get me to know it, like, for real inside of me. It's all easier said than done, but I'm working on it. And it is getting easier. If anything, being with the people here, I've almost started to feel a little proud of my illness. Well, not proud of it exactly, but proud that I'm facing it and finally learning how to live. The people I've met here, they are some strong motherfuckers. Sweet Pea Yuka, my roommate Max, they've all been through more shit than anyone I've ever met before. And they are good people. Emotionally disturbed, sure, but good people nonetheless. Of all the kids in here, it's really that poor Steven who's the hardest to figure out. Those vocalization things seem to get worse whenever he's in group, or talking about any kind of emotional anything. When he's just hanging out watching TV or something, they go away. It's totally weird. But he's super nice. Gentle and sweet. He sits cross-legged in the group and rocks back and forth. There's a podium set up, and this young, very pretty woman, probably around 35, is going on and on about how great her life is now, even though she's a schizo like us. The woman said her name at the beginning of her share, but I can't remember it now. She's wearing a collared shirt and jeans, and has really long, slender fingers that keep tapping on the podium as she talks. To tell you the truth, most of what she's said so far has kind of just blended together into one generic self-help amalgamation. But then, slowly, a little bit at a time, I start focusing more on what it is she's actually saying. And it's crazy how similar her delusions were to mine. Not about Teddy or making up some person that doesn't even exist, but about God talking to her like I thought he was talking to me. About that power coming into her life the same way it did into mine. She takes a drink of water from the bottle on the podium. And I really believed it. I thought God was telling me things. To the point that God was telling me I should jump off the Golden Gate Bridge so I could prove to the world that I was an angel. She goes on to tell the story of how she tried to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, but was stopped by a man riding across on his bike. Then she tells us how she got into treatment and got on medication, and the rest is pretty typical, I guess. But that stuff about God talking to her and all that, I keep on playing it over and over in my mind. The woman finishes her talk and a few people clap. Juanica, this girl around my age who's super nice and super beautiful, gives me a look with her eyes wide, and we go out to the balcony together to smoke. Jesus Christ, I say, leaning out into the gray, looking down on the back loading dock. Yeah, she says, another fun-filled day in the psych ward. I drag on my cigarette and ash over the railing. You're leaving tomorrow? I ask. Even though I know the answer to my own question. She nods. Do you think you're ready? Yes, I think I'm ready. What about you? You're leaving tomorrow too, right? Yeah. I pause and think and pick at my thumbnail. How do you deal with knowing that so much of what you thought was real totally wasn't? Like that woman thinking God was talking to her and everything. She smiles. Or like you and your fake dead brother? Exactly. I just don't know how we're gonna do this. Or how I will, anyway. Yeah, man, I get it. The other day I had my mom bring in one of my old notebooks. I wanted to see what the hell I'd been writing all that time. You know what it was? Pages and pages of tiny little symbols. No words. Scribbles. Fucking crazy. I sit down next to Juanica and cross my legs and tell her, I didn't just have an imaginary brother. All that God stuff she was talking about,
I'm serious. I felt the same way. Like God was talking to me. She laughs, and her eyes turn brighter green, and her teeth flash white, and I think, for the 50 billionth time, how goddamn beautiful she is. And how that shouldn't matter at all. That's nothing, she says. I think we've all had God talking to us at one point or another.
Really?
Really. The sliding glass door opens then, and that creepy Carl comes lurking out. You know you aren't allowed to be out here without supervision? Juanica narrows her eyes at him.
We'll come inside in a minute.
No, you'll come inside now. He stands watching us from the doorway. Juanica puts her hand on my shoulder.
Look, she says. You can do this. I don't want to see you turn into one of these people who end up stuck in institutions their whole life.
Like that roommate of yours. He's been in and out of psych wards for over 3 years. He could leave if he wanted to. He's just too scared.
Yeah, I know. But I want to go home. I want to be with my friends and family again.
She turns to look at me.
What about that girl, huh?
I stub my cigarette out in the ashtray.
Eliza?
No. I don't want to see her.
Good. Because she sounds like a bitch to me.
I shake my head.
She's not a bitch. Trust me, man, I can be a bitch. So I know what I'm saying when I say that she is a bitch.
I laugh with her. She's such a strong, beautiful girl. Dr. Frankel is right. I need friends right now. And I think maybe Juanica is my friend.
Look, she continues. You're sick, I'm sick. You made up an imaginary brother. I stalked my anthropology teacher. But you're a good fucking person. And I'm a good fucking person. The only reason we did that shit was because we were sick.
But so what? We're fucking sick and we take medication. What's the big deal?
Would you be blaming yourself if you had fucking cancer or some shit?
I laugh. Probably.
Well, that's because you're a nice person. But you gotta stop it. Stop being so nice.
Okay, I say. I'll try. She stands up straight, and I stand up too.
Thank you, I tell her.
You're sweet to me.
We're both getting out of here tomorrow, man. We gotta stick together.
We will. Carl yells at us again to come inside. Juanica takes my hand in hers. And we go in together. 46. Today I leave the psych ward. I'm fucking scared. But I'm ready. The only thing is, in order to agree to let me leave, Dr. Frankel and Dr. Dubonis want me to have a meeting with my parents to finally talk about Teddy, and what that means going forward. Because as it is now, I still haven't told them anything about what happened. I guess it makes sense. Keeping our disease a secret, and hiding our symptoms, is part of what makes recovery from this fucking thing so goddamn hard. That's what they say here, anyway. I've got to learn how to open up about my illness. Like those crows I was seeing all the time. I should have talked about them with someone. Dr. Frankel, at least. If there's a silver goddamn lining to all this, it's that I'm learning to manage my illness. It doesn't get any fucking better than that. But still, that's not so bad.
Not really.
So I make my bed like I'm supposed to every day. I make my bed, and Max makes his bed, and he says to me,
Your parents coming today?
Uh-huh. I nod. He keeps on scratching behind his ear and does a little head twitch thing.
Good luck.
I reach out my hand. He shakes it nervously.
Thanks, man.
Both Dr. Frankel and Dr. Dubonis are already in the group room, sitting and talking with my mom and dad. My parents have been here several times before, obviously, but it's actually the first time we're all meeting together, with both of my doctors. It's a gray day. The cold light streams dully across the polished linoleum tile floor. Artwork is hung around the room, including one of my own drawings done with colored pencils and charcoal. Faces coming out of faces. Crows circling a young boy crouched on the sand. I walk into the room, and my mom and dad both get up and they hug me. And my dad says, "We're proud of you." And my mom says,
Hey. She looks the same in many